Ladies and gentlemen, from Minnesota Soybean Processors, the moderator of this morning's panel discussion, Ron Marr.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Black Gold Texas Tea Panel. I'm Ron Marr. I represent the Minnesota Soybean Processors, a biodiesel producer in Brewster, Minnesota, a big town of 532 people. Also, I had a history as a petroleum marketer. About 20 years, I was involved in the marketing and wholesaling of petroleum. And I served recently as the chair of the NBB's RFS2 working group. It's my pleasure today to introduce our panelists. From Morgan Stanley Commodities, John Cusick. Come on out, John. From the Kinder Morgan Pipeline Group, Jim Lilio. Come on, Jim. From Marathon Petroleum Company, David Blacknick. Welcome, Dave.
Good morning.
From Magellan Midstream Partners, Bruce Hine. And from Northville Product Services, Mike Reed. Before we get going here, I'd like to encourage the audience to participate by texting or tweeting their questions to the address up on the screen. In the second half of the panel, we'll answer as many as we can. Let's get started. So, good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to our panel. Are we ready? Did you have a good night?
Yes, sir. I did.
Liver function test?
All good. All
passed. We're going to kind of start with an easy question here. Most of you were early adopters of the biodiesel industry or biodiesel as a product. How come? Dave, you're a Marathon guy.
Well, you know, Ron, Marathon's the fifth largest refiner in the U.S. and the largest refiner in the Midwest. And we've started with our renewable fuels program about 30 years ago with ethanol. We've adopted a lot of other programs in biodiesel now. And we've looked at it in a lot of different ways. A lot of customer demand has driven where we've gone with our renewable fuels program. On the biodiesel arena, we've actually looked at Minnesota as really our first volley into that. We started by starting in 2002, looking at what we had to do to put biodiesel into our system. And from there, we actually implemented in 2005 as the mandate came in place. And then from there, we actually started going back to customer demand. And we put biodiesel in Illinois and Kentucky, where there were incentives for our customers, and our customers actually asked for the products.
Bruce, you're another pipeline guy, a little bit different than David, but you've been around biodiesel a long time, your company.
Well, first, top of the morning to you all. And it's a privilege for me to be here with John and Jim and Dave and Mike and you, Ron. So thanks for the opportunity for inviting Magellan. We're a pipeline and terminal distribution company. Most of our pipeline infrastructure is in the Midwest, from here in Texas going north up into North Dakota, and every state in between. So wherever there's corn and soybean grown here in the Midwest, we normally find a Magellan terminal. And we like to say that we're in the energy distribution business, so we make our bread and butter with petroleum products like gasoline and diesel and jet fuel that ship on our pipeline. But our involvement with renewables has been growing very similar to Marathon's story. Back 30 years ago, we made our first investment in ethanol blending infrastructure in Des Moines, Iowa. Now, as it relates to biodiesel, our first entry into biodiesel distribution was indeed in Minnesota, which was driven by the state legislature's mandate, which occurred several years ago, began back in 2005. Out of some 1,500 petroleum distribution terminals in the United States, there are only approximately 60 that have biodiesel blending infrastructure today, and we have 12 of those at Magellan. And by terminal blending infrastructure, and I suspect we'll talk a lot about that today, that means a standalone tank that's insulated, heat trace lines to the loading rack, in a sophisticated ratio-type blending system. So these investments have been escalating in cost over the last couple of years due to a number of factors. And today they range in the $2.5 to $3 million range per distribution terminal. So we've been around biodiesel quite a bit, various parts of our company from commercial to quality control in the technical arena. We've done a lot of testing with biodiesel at our laboratory in Kansas City over the past decade. And we look forward to the future opportunities it brings.
Interesting answer. Mike, you're trade biodiesel and also kind of put in the pipeline. So what's your viewpoint?
Ron, we started with biodiesel back in 05 and 06. We have a big heating oil presence in the Northeast, large pipeline origination in the Gulf Coast for diesel. We got into it because it was profitable, one. Two, it was very synergistic to what we already did on both the heating oil and the origination side of the business. And we were one of the first movers in Colonial Pipeline to move the test batch. We were ready to go and had contracts signed. So we've been watching this, and we've been very excited about it.
Yeah, Jim, from Kinder Morgan's perspective, biodiesel fits in. Where's your piece of the puzzle?
You bet. Kinder Morgan is the largest independent terminaling company. We have 18,000 miles of refined products pipelines and nearly 80 liquid terminals. And our business is based on what the customer wants. Many of our customers sit here, are out there. They're oil companies, they're distributors, they're producers, marketers. When they come to us and say, go ahead and utilize those assets to go ahead and get our product to the end user, that's what we do. And that's pretty much what's started our business, and we're going to keep growing on that.
And lastly, John, you have a little different perspective than all of us up in there in the Northeast. And I understand you have some involvement in bioheat.
Yeah, I think similar to Northville, a lot of our decisions were market-driven. About 2 years ago, we saw the clear opportunity for biodiesel in the heating oil pool and began to work with close partners such as Bruce and Jim's companies to build out the infrastructure to support, ratable supply up into those markets. Similar to Marathon, we had the precedent of the ethanol business as our first sort of entrance into the biofuel space. For the heating oil pool, we see biodiesel just as a clear piece of the future for that industry and that grade of distillery.
Well, one of the reasons we're all here today in this room is with the advent of the RFS2 rules, I think about a week ago today. And essentially what RFS2 has done is probably a groundbreaking step in America, and it's going to define the composition of motor fuels. And for this audience, we're all kind of focused on biodiesel. We all know that many individual states have individual state mandates requiring fuel composition. Do you see that in conflict with RFS2 or synergy with RFS2, or what's your outlook on it? Dave, you've had probably the longest experience.
Ron, the state mandates actually put everybody in that state on a level playing field. But they also create an island. And a lot of state supplies don't necessarily come from that state. So you have to really look at a state and also how they're supplied in those states. So when we look at them, although it puts us on a level playing field, you may not want to put infrastructure in at every terminal that supplies that state, because it may be a small amount. You may be sitting just inside Wisconsin and have to supply into Minnesota. And with that, it may be a very small amount of your product. And so looking at it to spend the $2 or $3 million infrastructure for something that is a very small amount kind of hurts. So when we look back at them, although it does level the playing field, everybody has to engage in it in that area. State by state kind of hurts. The RFS takes us across the full board, and everybody has to participate in a certain volume now.
I'm going to kind of pick on the guys that have to deliver the product, so that'd be, Bruce's be next on the Magellan. Do you have the same kind of feeling that Dave has?
Very similar in regards to the individual state mandates. And as a independent service provider, transportation service provider, we don't take positions on advocating one fuel over the other. So in other words, if there's an ethanol or a biodiesel mandate proposed in the state legislature, we generally don't get involved unless the legislation and the way that it's drafted creates some operational problems or what we envision would be unintended consequences could come from, for example. So if a state enacts a biofuel mandate, whether it's ethanol or biodiesel, one of the main things for us and what we look at, Ron, is the certainty that that creates. In other words, we really look for the states to uphold what they've done. And by altering it or changing it in mid-course after the law has been passed, that can really create complications for companies like us that make decisions to go and invest on multi-million dollar projects only to see that the law has changed or there's waivers granted due to unexpected circumstances. So Once these biofuel requirements are passed on an individual state basis, we hope that they stay in place as originally expected. Now, the RFS2 creates a real opportunity as it relates to future investment, and we'll look at that on a case-by-case basis. As Dave mentioned, some terminals that may have smaller diesel demand or throughput may not be ideal locations right off the bat to potentially make investments. Larger terminals, the way that we'll look at that is to make those decisions in conjunction with our customers, to provide the services where they want them, in the region of the country they want them, in the exact location where they really need them to satisfy their renewable fuel requirements.
Well, can I jump on that with the you talked about the groundbreaking nature of RFS2, but the states, the individual steps, it gets it started, gets certain momentum. But you can't forget history here and what the RFS2, starting with the Energy EPACT, then the Energy Independent Security Act, what those did, let's just focus what it did for parts of ethanol. Now, I think you have to take into account there are some similarities there. You backstopped production. You backstopped infrastructure development. Kinder Morgan had 2.5 million barrels of storage for ethanol in 2006. And as the national momentum and our customers, obligated parties, and desire to blend the product, we're in 2010, we've nearly doubled. We're at 4.5 million barrels of storage. Throughput has nearly tripled. We're at 66 million barrels of throughput in 2010 is our forecast. Now, three things. What that did is it standardized the product, the processes, so our customers know when they get it in New York Harbor, it's similar to what they're asking for out on the West Coast and in the Gulf Coast. One other thing that was going along, it had incentives, financial incentives were there to go ahead and do it. But the specs were the same, the mandate is there, and financials. You get all that momentum going, that's what is really the game changer to go ahead and move more barrels.
Well, let's go down one more step, and this may be kind of another critical question. We've got an RFS2 coming at us. Looks like somewhere around 800 million gallons of biodiesel, you know, rough numbers, and we don't really know until you do the calculus through it. You guys all have the infrastructure in place to blend it. You know, I'm going to start with you, Jim.
Sure. All right. Well, take a look up on the screen. We do have projects in place. We are looking at, on the West Coast, putting Portland to Eugene pipeline. Has already been tested and ready for when the state mandate is in place. We'll go ahead and be able to start moving product there. Since July 2009, we have had the capability. Look at the dark blue line starting in Collins, Mississippi through Roanoke, Virginia. We have had the capability to blend and move over 10,000 barrels a day of B5 product. We're out in front of the customers right now, and again, going along with the RFS2, as greater needs are there, we can go ahead and ramp this up within 6 months to move 100,000 barrels a day of blended B5. That number, thank you. No, come on. All right. But that number, if you take the actual biodiesel portion, it's larger than the number that Shelby mentioned yesterday that all state mandates can, at their maximum, currently move in the three states, Minnesota, Oregon, and Washington. That, just that pipeline, what its capabilities are, will be larger than everything there. So you essentially double what's out there in the mandate. We also are coming out to our customers down in Florida to offer biodiesel blending at Orlando. We have the major marketing terminal there in Orlando. So what we're doing, again, is as customers need it, we will provide the infrastructure, but we need their support to go ahead and fund it.
Bruce and I imagine Magellan's kind of in the same ballpark. You're looking at return on asset.
Well, that's the key, is we look for our customers to help participate in these types of investments. And it's a good partnership to where the pipeline company's willing or the distribution company's willing to make those investments with the help of the customers and their willingness to help support that commitment. As it relates to biodiesel blends in the pipe, as the volume continues to grow, opportunities to transport these blends, low-level blends, B5 and under, those opportunities will increase. We've done some blends down in the Houston area successfully. There'll be other pockets to where that may make some sense in the future. For the larger distribution moves and to see biodiesel blends evolve into the mainstream system, There needs to be some developments on the aviation side to take place and to deal with the issue of trail back to where there can be some allowable level of biodiesel to potentially enter into the jet fuel stream. Once those issues are addressed over time, that opens up more and more opportunities. However, for us, the way that we look at biodiesel distribution in the short term is to continue to see terminal level blending evolve. There are a number of benefits that come along with terminal level blending, and in our core markets in the Midwest, we have a lot of biodiesel plants that surround our terminals, so transportation into our terminal system is very cost effective. But the terminal level blending provides a number of different benefits, including B2, B5, B10, and B20 menus. If economics change or if other programs come into place to drive one of those two or four blends, then they're available. If for example, we would have brought biodiesel blends into Minnesota recently via pipeline, that would have created some real challenges for us with the change in the biodiesel requirement in Minnesota temporarily being only limited to number two oil or our ultra-low sulfur diesel. So if we had biodiesel blends that were arriving into our Minnesota terminals that were already blended at B5, both the number one and the number two oil, that would have really created some operational and commercial challenges for us. So in that particular case, we're very glad that we had terminal level blending in place, and we think that's in our foreseeable future as well.
Hey,
Ron, if you look at this, and in 2007, December, RFS2 was passed. NISA was there. And we've been working on a strategy to how we handle that requirement since then. We had teams in place in January of 2008 and trying to figure out how and where we make these investments. Mm-hmm. And even sitting here, I applaud the pipeline companies for looking to move the product into pipeline. We've done a pipeline test ourselves. But when you step back and look at that, even this discussion here today, how much can be moved, where can it be moved, 2 years ago you would have said pipeline or biodiesel couldn't be moved on the pipeline. Today we're talking about moving biodiesel on the pipeline. That's a huge step, and that's something that in 2 years we've grown. But yet it's still then, I have to sit back and say, do I make a terminal investment or do I wait and rely on the pipeline system? So there's still a lot of uncertainty of how we make those investments and what we do. But again, the pipelines are starting to step up, and you are starting to see that. So
that's a great lead into the next question. We'll just kind of diverge here a little bit from the topic. There's going to be a ramp-up period to get infrastructure. I mean, it's evident that you just don't build a tank tomorrow and have it. So you got pipelines, you got terminals across the country that need to have infrastructure put in, and it'll take time to go through the permitting and everything. So what do you do in between? You've got a calculus of we maybe have an expired blending credit that may be coming back retroactively, we think hopefully fairly quick. You've got a RIN obligation of, particularly Dave, or an obligated party of 2010. You don't know if you can blend it. You don't know exactly what's your calculus on what you're going to do. Any idea, Dave, for Mike and John, down there? I mean, are you going to buy RINs? Are you going to blend biodiesel?
Kind of jumping in, again, we have, the way the RFS rules came out, you're allowed to bring your 2008s, 2009 RINs in to reduce your obligation. So when we look at that, we go back and say, what have we done in 2008? What have we done in 2009? We have purchased some RINs. We've blended. So taking all of that into account, we look at 2010 saying what we're blending today, what we've blended in the past. We may be okay for 2010. Looking at our infrastructure, I have biodiesel at 5 of our 67 terminals. I know I have to make that infrastructure investment to increase our blending to meet our capacity. So when we step back and look at that, we have to go and for 2011, we have to have infrastructure in place. So we will have to add capital and projects.
Yeah, Mike, you're kind of on both sides of the fence in that one.
Yeah, we're an obligated party, but at the same time, with a trading view versus an asset-based view that Marathon and some of the other obligated parties, I think it boils down to economics, whether can you blend a biodiesel blend, strip the RINs, and is it economical in the market that you're in? Are you hitting a state mandate? Are there tax credits in that state? I think at the end of the day, the majors are going to do kind of a blend of all those things to find, to find the right mix and economic value in the proposition.
So RIN may actually be more valuable than the biodiesel.
I think in certain states, in certain areas, absolutely.
Yeah. John, what do you see? It's your ball.
Yeah, but I think thing stands out for me. If you put the infrastructure in place, you're obviously looking to get a return on that. So for a lot of us, you know, our strategy is very much to continue to blending biodiesel into that distillate pool. But that obviously makes the dollar essential because we're not quite in a mandated market, although we're with RFS2 moving in that direction. We need that dollar to make the economics work on the blend, because at the end of the day, at least for the heating oil pool, it still needs to be an economic blend stock. In addition, I think Morgan Stanley, for sort of next steps, we're looking very much at the states and trying to build a trading platform right now. The amount of grades you need to manage to try to manage all the different state preferences and the different moving targets right now as far as feedstock preferences and biodiesel grade preferences right now, the system you need to have is pretty significant, especially in the Northeast with some of the low carbon fuel standard initiatives and other vehicles in motion now with RFS. So I think it's challenging right now in the sense that, you know, you've put the money forward, but there's still a lot of work to do to really, I think, create some structure to this U.S. market and launch it.
You know, on that note, Ron, if I may, it takes on average 9 to 12 months for us to construct a normal terminal blending infrastructure system. And one of the more important pieces of that, particularly in the Northeast or in the Midwest as you go further north, is to begin those projects at the appropriate time. You can't, in other words, lay a foundation for an above-ground storage tank in the middle of the winter. You either have to do it in the fall or wait for the spring. So as it relates to individual state mandates, and I know several states are considering adopting those, including Iowa, it's very, very important that the beginning of the mandate start at an appropriate time of the year that allows the industry time to develop the infrastructure necessary to carry out large-scale biodiesel blending programs. So if you rely completely on off-site bulk plant or splash blending types of systems, that would be very, very challenging to see something like that be workable for a large-scale state mandate itself. So from an infrastructure standpoint, 9 to 12 months and starting the programs in the right time of the year.
Let's keep kind of going on RINs. RINs kind of renewable fuel identification numbers for anyone in the audience. It's kind of new to the industry. Coming from the old petroleum industry and back in the early days of ethanol, you saw almost all the ethanol blended below the rack. And as time went on and as ethanol had a little more history, it moved to the rack to be blended. Well, biodiesel right now, there's a lot of biodiesel blended below the rack. And the one question I've had, and it's kind of been a curious question to think about over the last few months, is it's hard for me to imagine an obligated party, a refiner, and unfortunately, Dave, I'm going to pick on you here a little bit, wanting to give up X percent of your wet gallons of diesel fuel or in this even ethanol or gasoline for ethanol, and only to go out and buy RINs and be, you know, long gas, short RINs. Do you see more branding supply agreements that will go to like a B5? If you're going to buy diesel from Marathon, it'll be a B5 or a B2 or a B whatever. Or you think you'll still be out short RINs and have to buy them? Just your crystal ball on that. And I'm going to ask John and Mike on the same question too.
I'd say the crystal ball on that is that we're going to look to meet our obligation with wet gallons over time, whether it's through our infrastructure, through somebody else's, through a pipeline system that's delivering to us, whether that's, you know, building out our infrastructure, using another. I think, again, your point is, why should I just go pay for a RIN? And in reality, in the marketplaces, somebody has to generate that RIN. Today we're looking at biodiesel, and it's also a RIN that goes into the advanced non-cellulosic category. So, I can take that biodiesel and use it in two different categories. So, you know, even though I may have a set obligation under biodiesel, I also have obligations really in four different categories and four buckets. And so if I can take that biodiesel and move it into those other buckets, that's going to help me. They've come up with a cellulosic diesel category now that actually would allow you to take a diesel pool and put it into your cellulosic pool. So a lot of these different things we'll start to look at and say, as we approach the E10 blend wall in ethanol, can I move distillate and do more? So can I do more biodiesel into my pool, into my distillate, to help me get around that E10 blend wall? So these are all things, strategy-wise, that we're looking at today and things that we have to figure through.
What's your Northeast Ouija board saying?
Well, I think we applaud the EPA for identifying heating oil as a channel to move biodiesel into and allowing the RIN value to now be captured as of July. And that's a big development, of course, for that Northeast, that heating oil blending. But I think in general, you know, we've had three successful years up there blending into that heating oil pool, but that's been key. You know, what's been key to that is that dollar per gallon credit to make the economics work. So for us, you know, managing that, the trading of that agricultural to energy to make those economics work, to make that sort of short open, if you will, the heating oil, is a key focus for us. Now, obviously, with the new development on the RINs front, that becomes a very interesting add-on to our business up in the Northeast. But, you know, in general, I think we're very focused on the return of that investment and focus on continuing to blend into that heating oil pool.
Mike?
I think, you know, RFS2 is a mandate to blend biodiesel into the pool of diesel. It's not necessarily a mandate to put it in your vehicle or to offer it at every station. So I think the state mandates really help you focus on how to get it to the pump. That along, again, it's an economic and a compliance issue. That along with the state tax credits and issues, that will also focus you to get it to that market, because economically, assuming the dollar tax credit is there, economically that's where you want it. That's where you want it. It would be much better to blend it and break even or even make a few cents with the wet barrel than to go out and cover it with a RIN. But sometimes the RINs may be cheaper because it's economically
just where you're at.
It's where you are. Yeah. It's where the barrel could get in. And you could get the RIN, you know, stripped
off. But overriding that for a pipeline terminal company, these are my customers here talking. They're saying that physical barrel is going to have to move. And, yes, we have to contend with a lot of the issues that Bruce is bringing up in timing, but we're going to have to come up with solutions, have them ready to go, and maybe work with the customers very early on in this to ensure that there's going to be assets out there, because physical barrel is going to go, whether it's you or your customer or the producer. Somebody's going to do it. We've got to have the infrastructure in there, and hopefully it doesn't take 9 to 12 months on every one of them once you've made that decision. Hopefully we can work with you to go ahead and shorten that time.
Bruce, you have about 2 seconds worth while I get my glasses out to read the new questions.
Well, the state requirements that we've all talked about do indeed play a very important role, and the timing of implementing these projects are also extremely important. The challenge for us, as we are an independent service provider, is again working with our customers to meet those needs, to focus on the economics of each and every deal as it relates to installing infrastructure and making wise investments at the time that they're needed in the market. And making an investment too early without having those meters spinning and moving biodiesel through would turn out to be an unfortunate decision. So the real challenge, and as a publicly held company, we're looking to maximize those investments at the right time. So the key for us is staying very close to our customers like Dave and John and Mike.
Well, this is a good question, and someone in the audience is a little sharper than I this morning. Mike and our end players, the two defensive ends here are going to get this one. Super Bowl question. When do you think biodiesel will be sold in the commodities market?
Well, I think, you know, there was a contract presented to the CBOT, I think, about 2 years ago, right, when the CME was sort of bringing the NYMEX and the CBOT exchanges together, and it seems to have been lost a little bit in that transition from my vantage point. But I think the biggest challenge is, unlike ethanol, material, it's not a fungible product today. We've got, you know, so many grades, and I think, you know, quite a bit of work to do to establish if blended grades with a sort of cloud point index is the future of how the material is sold. So there's still, I think, a few questions preventing that contract from being created. But I think we definitely see it residing on the NYMEX eventually.
Do you agree with that, Mike?
Well, the important thing about a futures contract is you have to have a delivery point, and you have to have a fungible spec. And everybody out there knows that there's multiple specs of biodiesel. The ASTM, as we discussed yesterday, is the minimum but everybody has taken that to another level. So you have to have a delivery point. So we have to decide whether it's New York Harbor, somewhere in Iowa, Houston.
Minnesota.
We have to establish a delivery point for the physical barrel, and I think that will play out over time as we develop, as we see where these barrels kind of start to aggregate. For ethanol, it's Chicago, not just because of the CBOT, but there was Kinder Morgan stepped out and took a very large position, and Argo is the physical delivery point.
We have a question here, and I think Bruce, you addressed it earlier. What's the average cost or range to add inline biodiesel blending in a terminal? Didn't you say it's around $2 to $3 million?
Right, $2.5 to $3 million is the current cost, and that has really gone up over the last couple of years.
And that's heated storage too.
Right, and what we're looking at for future investments. And I'll contrast this compared to where we are in Minnesota. What we installed early on in Minnesota were fairly small tanks, 2,000 barrels in size, which would approximately hold 10 full transport trucks of biodiesel. Now we're looking at 5 to 10,000 barrel tanks for the future. And part of that is driven due to the increase in B2 to B5. We would have liked larger storage in Minnesota. But for the future, that's what we're expecting to build is more in the 5 to 10,000 barrel range, Ron.
You know, Ron, just to that, I mean, when we start to look at infrastructure as well, a lot of terminals today, light products, what I'd go back and say major terminal, major oil company terminals, are not accessible by rail today. So when you look at that and we go back and kind of step back and say, how do we bring biodiesel in, and where are we at? So that's also part of the picture, is to step back and say, you know, if we're close enough to plants, we can truck it in. But we also have to start to look at either hubs for biodiesel into regions and areas that allow us to bring product in. So that's also part of our overall strategy when we start to look at this, say, you know, if I'm going to do something in the South, where can I get the bio? How can I aggregate it and get it in to markets?
That's kind of this question from the audience is kind of the same line. It says, in what states is the RFS most likely to be met and why? And I'm going to again turn to all four of you, I guess, and ask, probably it's where it's available. We're at Tourmaline and blending.
Yeah.
Accessibility to the product.
It's absolutely, the coastal city should be a good place if you can actually strip RINs off, which is what you can do in New York Harbor.
New York,
the state mandated areas, the tax incentive areas, those should be the states that the wet barrel should pay to be there.
What we do is we go ahead and listen to our customers when they say, here are the areas we want to go. We compare that with operationally what a terminal has to do. We don't want to come back to them and say, it's 12 months for me to go ahead and provide that to you if you're asking for it now. What we are seeing is decrease in gasoline, jet fuel, and distillate out there at all of our terminals. So there are certain ones where you can go ahead and optimize the tankage, what we've done down in Tampa. We were able to optimize some tankage for ethanol. Now we've got the ability to handle biodiesel down there. What we have to do is just invest in the heating of the tank, blending, and be able to put it over the rack. That's a heck of a lot quicker to get that asset up and running than it would be to build all brand new infrastructure for this. So you look for those opportunities where the customer's saying, you say, it might not be exactly there. How about this? There's going to be some blending of the minds and hopefully come together. That's the optimization that we're talking about, looking for ways to get this out to the most advantaged markets as quickly as possible. Those are the kind of things you got to solve.
I think we see that the pipelines eventually are really going to be pretty key to those markets being developed. I mean, having bought the Transmontane system 2 or 3 years ago at Morgan Stanley, you know, that's a system, you know, we're waiting for this market to evolve to begin making some key decisions on how we roll biodiesel out through it.
Seems like it's almost a build it and they will come.
Well, I think it's a spec issue. We've come a long way in just a short time in the spec. I mean, for those that are regularly blending into the distillate pool, they've seen the improvements of the quality of the material, the continuity of the specs.
Jump in on that one. That's a good, really, a question I think we need to talk about just briefly. We may have a big ramp up in volume produced.
Mm-hmm.
What are your fears on quality? What do you think? I mean, you guys have to handle it, and I'll just start with Dave. You've had Dave and Bruce both have had hands on in that.
You know, again, I'd go back in our experience in Minnesota, and when they had the waivers, we continued to sell biodiesel through our commercial store, Speedway Super America, the entire time they had the waiver on. We still sold the B2, even though the waiver was in place and we didn't have to, because we didn't have a problem. And so when you step back, and one of the things, and one of the reasons we didn't have a problem was the blending system we put in, and two, we went out and vetted the processors and the suppliers that we were buying product from. And one of the things that our product quality group will do ahead of us purchasing is go out and really vet a facility. How are they processing it? You know, again, everyone goes back and you may get stuck, and we were stuck on soy for a long time. And now we step back and say, hey, maybe we can be feedstock agnostic when we go back and say, now that the specs have come along a little bit different. But yet it goes back to how is it processed? And so we're starting to look back and say, you know, where's the facility? What processes are they using? And then from there we're saying, let us test your products.
Do you see our specs getting more stringent or more uniform? Because probably you guys, the traders on the two ends here, Mike and John, you're probably seeing different specs and different trades.
Different specs, different feedstocks, sustainability issues. It's the ASTM is the ticket to the game. That's the minimum. But it's we worked with Kinder Morgan on the plantation. Every company has their own little twist they want to put on the spec, and that's an issue when you start putting it in the pipe and going across 13, 14 states. So ASTM did a lot to get us at least, you know, the minimum that you got good quality. Now it's a matter of these little adders that keep getting, you know, pushed by the major.
Mike, you talked about that plantation pipeline, putting biodiesel before. It was the first pipeline to go ahead and run commercial movements to major markets. And in order to do that, you don't want to have any mess up. So we had an awful lot of inputs. We had a lot of companies, individual companies, coming back saying, this is what I want to see. Another one was over here. But what we have seen, now we came out with Florida, going ahead and offer there. The responses are narrowing down. It isn't a pinpoint, but it's narrowing down.
From
and they're
a pipeline
getting more
perspective,
uniform.
You don't want to have 54 specs.
No.
You don't want to try and ship one fungible number up that's good in Texas, good in Minnesota.
That's right. You want to
so
have,
you see that narrowing down to more and more, it's tighter.
And that's valuable. It's more efficient, and it's less likely to have any problems that come up, because those problems cost money, time, and it reduces the confidence of the customer in the overall process.
Well, and from a liquidity perspective on a trading basis, the more fungibilized we can get, the more options that we have to put barrels into the market.
And I think with that said, we have to listen, you know, to the Bruce's and Jim's and these companies that are pushing the sort of heightened specs right now to ASTM, the monoglycerides, the certain things you're starting to hear about where we see that ASTM spec going and in turn the producers needing to meet.
And I don't think you can discount the fact, too, that distillate has a wide range. You can take four refineries in Illinois, and every one of them, distillate, looks different. So you almost have to narrow the spec of biodiesel down because you're going into a big difference. And unlike ethanol and gasoline, where gasoline's pretty standard, you pretty much have a spec, and ethanol's a spec, you got a big wide range in your distillate coming off of different refineries and different units. And then with that, you have a biodiesel that's got a wide range of specs. So you're trying to hit numbers, and it really does create a lot of issues down the road for us.
It's an expensive proposition. I mean, the testing that goes in, you know, with the grades of biodiesel, every batch being a little different, and the same variability on the diesel side. I mean, the testing bills we've been running this year have been astronomical.
One of the things that's important for us is the ability to commingle biodiesel. In other words, the terminals will look to make an investment in one storage tank. We're not going to have two or three or multiple tanks available for different types of biodiesel. And that's really important because it helps keep the cost down in regards to your overall distribution costs. And that's why we believe it's essential as we move forward and make future investments that biodiesel is fungible, just like vitamin D milk, and we're able to commingle various different products from a wide variety of producers as long as they're on our approved supplier list.
A couple of easy questions, and these are yes or no questions for Bruce and Jim. Do they need to clean tanks to move from B0 to B5 in terminal blending? So if you don't have a biodiesel tank existing, does that have to be cleaned to terminal B5?
Well, in all of our biodiesel tanks, they've all been brand new with new heating elements and new insulation, so there's no cleaning involved. They were constructed.
I think if this is converting an existing number two tank to be whatever, should be able to just go into it.
That's exactly right. It's a very easy conversion. Or you can have a straight ULSD tank, and we bring, along the plantation system, we have a straight ULSD tank that we will bring B5 in behind it, as long as we know what's in that tank at any one time. That's what our customers need to know.
We're down about 3 minutes, I think. says, what problems have you encountered in piping biodiesel in cold and hot climates from gelling and contamination? Anything on the pipes that you can tell us?
In our case, and Jim may have quite a bit more on this, but in our case, from Galena Park, Texas, which is in the ship channel in Houston, to a terminal some 15 miles away, we've done that on a number of occasions and had good success. So we haven't shipped biodiesel blends in cold weather to be able to answer the second part of that question.
Yeah, we have some tanks down in the Gulf Coast where we haven't had to heat the systems. Down in Florida, we haven't. But as we go in larger volumes and consistency of supply that our customers are going to require as part of their obligations, we are going to have to insert the heating units on straight biodiesel. But when it gets blended, once it's blended, we are not running into those same issues. Then it does not have any issues with the cold flow properties once it goes on the pipeline or is a blended product at a small blend of B5 to B20.
Bruce, I just got the high sign that we got 2 minutes left, and this question looks like it's kind of come to you. It said, Bruce mentioned the B5 bill in Iowa. What would be the impact on biodiesel sales there? Would they likely exceed the demand created by the requirement itself, which I think is the RFS requirement? If they went to B5, would that satisfy Iowa's RFS requirement, which isn't really an Iowa requirement?
No, it's not. As Dave mentioned, the RFS is really a national program and gives the flexibility to blend anywhere that you choose that makes the most sense for you as the obligated party. In the state of Iowa, I am assuming that there's adequate production to meet the demand for a B5 program. And our big concern there is just to make sure that if it's the will of the legislature, thus the will of the people and the will of the governor, to give the industry adequate time to prepare for that instead of leaving it all up to off-site splash-type blending operations, which we don't think would work in a large-scale mandate of that nature.
Well, I think we kind of reached the end of our time here. It's been a fun panel. This kind of went a little more informal than we even dreamed. We hope we've picked your interest in a lot of these questions and that you take questions to the rest of the seminars, particularly the EPA and the RIN seminar tomorrow afternoon, and maybe we've whetted your appetite for more information. So I think we are pretty close to being done. So thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Bruce.